From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Congress has overwhelmingly passed a $286 billion transportation bill, set to be signed as early as tomorrow by the president. A mountain of money to patch up America's roads and a heaping helping of pork, too. But whether the bill will ease the great American traffic jam is still in doubt. Congestion costs Americans millions of hours and billions of dollars a year, not to mention frustration, road rage, addiction to foreign oil, and more pollution. Public transport hasn't licked the problem. Now comes a push for market dynamics on the nation's roads, for private highways and higher tolls for high-speed lanes. How you feel about that may depend on the size of your wallet and your blood pressure on the road. This hour on Point, the push to pay for speed on America's highways. And later in the hour, a new report on lobbying as the number one career choice for ex-congressmen. But we begin in Washington, where the transportation bill is waiting on the president's desk. Joining me now is Eamon Javers, Capitol Hill correspondent for Business Week magazine. Eamon Javers, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So this is a famously pork-filled bill, but there's a lot in here for new roads and highways and highway repairs as well. Talk to us about the scale and the time frame for what's been passed overwhelmingly by both houses of Congress here.
Well, what's interesting here is that this really blows out of the water the previous records for number of earmarks. Those are the specific measures for specific members of Congress that really are where the pork meets the road here. They're going to sign this bill tomorrow in Montgomery, Illinois, in the home district of House Speaker Dennis Hastert. And Hastert himself has become a master of political pork. According to the group Taxpayers for Common Sense, he himself, just alone as one member of Congress, has gotten $397 million in transportation projects for his district and the surrounding area. That blows away the average member of Congress, who gets just a paltry $12.8 million for each congressional district. But that's all part of the 6,371 total earmarks for a grand total of $24.1 billion of what critics call pure congressional pork spending.
And we see that for the bridges to nowhere in Alaska, the bridge out of Anchorage named Don Young's Way for the
right.
chairman of the Transportation Committee
they,
there.
They used to wait until the guy was dead to name the bridge after him, but that seems to have fallen by the wayside, and they're going to name it after the current chairman.
Citizens Against Government Waste calls this bill one of the biggest boondoggles in the history of federal spending. Yet for all that, take away the quarter or $25 billion in pork, and that's still a lot of money to go into the roads. There's a lot of infrastructure that needs attention here.
Sure, and every member of Congress who voted for this bill, and it passed overwhelmingly, just a few disgruntled Puritans voted against it. Every member of Congress who has a project in this bill says, look, this is crucial infrastructure back in my district. We have to stop the number of traffic accidents, traffic congestion, and this is a jobs and economy-boosting bill. And the folks back home generally agree with that. Everyone's opposed to pork, except when it's that extra lane on the highway that you're stuck on every morning in your morning commute.
But several of our guests this hour, Eamon, are saying for all that money, it's not going to solve America's traffic jams. You may put up some fresh roads, you may patch up some potholes, but Americans are still going to spend a lot of time sitting in gridlock.
Well, I'll tell you, in Washington, this bill is used as a way to break congressional gridlock, and the tactics on this are what's fascinating to those of us who are stuck inside the Beltway watching this thing get passed. You know, the House leadership last week held this highway bill vote until after the politically tricky vote on the CAFTA trade agreement, and that meant that the members of Congress who were casting these very difficult votes on CAFTA knew that the projects that they wanted in the highway bill were at stake, really, if they voted against leadership and against CAFTA.
So if you want your pork sandwich, sign up on CAFTA, or you may not have it.
If you want your dessert, you got to eat your peas, and that's really what happened last week. Three members of Congress, it looks like, who were some of the most vocal opponents of CAFTA, Congressman Virgil Good of Virginia, Walter Jones of North Carolina, and Gil Gutnecht of Minnesota, had projects stripped out of the highway bill after voting against the leadership and voting against that CAFTA agreement. So,
and there, my friend, is how the sausage gets made.
That's exactly right. This highway bill is both a carrot and a stick for leaders to keep their caucus in line.
President likely to sign it tomorrow. Eamon Javers, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Eamon Javers, Capitol Hill correspondent for Business Week magazine. He spoke with us from Washington. We are talking about the drive to fill in the transportation bill's failings with private roads and higher tolls. You can join the conversation. If $286 billion isn't enough to ease traffic, is it time to go private, to raise tolls, or does that sound like the ultimate pothole to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Fort Lauderdale in Florida is Robert Poole, Director of Transportation at the Reason Foundation. He was part of the Bush-Cheney transition team and has advised the past four administrations on the privatization of transportation. The New York Times calls him the chief theorist for private solutions to gridlock. Robert Poole, thank you for being with us this morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And with me from Washington is Clifford Winston, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of You Can't Get There From Here, Government Failure in U.S. Transportation. Clifford Winston, thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you. Glad to be here.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, you ready to get your caddy out on the private highway of life?
Yes, I am. Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Let's dive in here. Clifford Winston, if I may come to you first. There was a provision tucked in this bill, and I wonder if it came out the other end, that would open a new window for financing of private highways in the United States. Is that afoot now?
I don't think that's a major part of the transportation bill. I think that the core of the transportation bill is still thinking about trying to spend your way out of congestion. And the notion of financing private highways, there may be some lip service to it, but that's not really the central part yet of what public policy toward highways is in this country.
But you're writing that no matter those billions and billions and billions that will be poured into highway and bridge construction maintenance here, American congestion, traffic congestion has grown much worse, and you will grow worse still. Why?
Well, there's obviously continued growth in population and continued growth in economic activity. And one thing that we need to keep in mind, it's not just cars that are part of this problem and affected by it, but it's also freight in the private sector. Trucking firms and shippers and so on and so forth are part of all of this. So with continued growth in population and economic activity, we're going to continue to have growth in congestion unless there are responses to it that try to minimize the impact of congestion.
But isn't $286 billion a sufficient response? Robert Poole, speak to us here. Why doesn't that much money buy clear roads or at least less congested roads?
The problem is that the political process that your correspondent described, first of all, earmarks a lot of that money for projects that are in places where it's not really needed, where it isn't going to solve this problem.
But less than one-tenth of that overall spending. That leaves than $250 billion.
But the same political process is at work in every state. And a state legislature is not going to sit back and spend, let's say, if they have $1 billion available for highways, you can be sure that money is going to be spread to every district in that state so that everybody gets their piece of the action.
And what's wrong with that if we're trying to address gridlock?
The problem is if we've got a huge problem in one particular large metro area, like Houston, let's say, or Minneapolis, where you'd need that whole $1 billion to make a serious dent in the congestion, you're not going to get it because the politics drives the solution to spread the money thinly everywhere so that everybody gets a piece. That's where the private sector approach comes in, and contrary to what Cliff implied, there is a breakthrough in the new bill. $15 billion worth of private sector financing has been authorized that was never possible before. Allowing private companies that propose toll additions to the highway system to issue tax-exempt toll revenue bonds on the same basis as state toll authorities can.
Texas, California, Virginia already at the forefront in this movement?
Yes, they are. The doors are open. They are accepting unsolicited proposals from private companies, some of them in the multi-billion dollar range.
Are Americans going to be driving in the future on more and more private highways, toll private highways?
It looks like, they're going to be driving on more and more tolled highways, probably some of them public, some of them private. But the good news there is that you can't finance a toll project, whether it's public or private, unless you can show pretty sophisticated complicated number crunching exercise that there really is a demand for that project. People will actually pay tolls to use it. So at least in this small piece of the overall equation, you're targeting the funds where they're going to produce the most return and the most real relief for drivers.
We're going to come back and look at where that money might be spent, where these new private highways may show up, where they're showing up already, who will have the cash to drive on them at those lovely high speeds. Jack Beatty, the old presumption was that providing roads would be overwhelmingly a public exercise.
Yes, although we did start here, this was how roads and bridges began in America, as franchise corporations. That is to say, the government didn't want to build them. They had tax rebellions. And so the politicians turned them over to corporations, which built these things. And for investors, they provided certainty of reward. They were monopolies. There was only one bridge over the river, and it was all yours. However, this soon led to problems. For example, in Cuyahoga, Lake Cuyahoga, the Cuyahoga Bridge Company had an exclusive contract to ferry anybody, take anyone across the lake by whatever medium, and the lake froze over. Someone tried to walk across it. They sued him. Well, absurdities like this mounted, and they helped to really fuel the Jacksonian revival and the Jacksonian attack on monopoly privilege. Mm. And the franchise corporation died when Jackson attacked the greatest one of them all, the National Bank.
Old Jackson may be headed down the highway. Jack, stick with us. Robert Poole, Clifford Winston, we're talking tonight about paying for speed on America's highways. If $286 billion isn't enough for the government to get you out of traffic, is it time to take the highways private? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this morning about paying for speed on America's highways, about the drive to fill in the transportation bill's failings with private roads and higher tolls. You can join the conversation this morning. Would you pay a higher toll to travel 20 miles per hour faster? Would that make the highways a rich man's world? And is it time to bring market dynamics to the problem of traffic gridlock? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joined this morning from Washington by Clifford Winston, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, from Fort Lauderdale by Robert Poole, Director of Transportation Studies at the Reason Foundation. Clifford, Jack Beatty is with us as well. We're glad to have him. Clifford Winston, I wish you'd describe the scale of the problem for us. I see you've written about how much time, how many hours each year Americans are spending stuck in gridlock. What is the cost in personal and economic terms?
Well, if you include motorists, truckers who have to deliver freight, and they are, too, also stuck in congestion, and the delay to shippers who have to hold higher inventories, it's on the order of $30 to $50 billion a year, depending on how you value an hour of time. So it's quite a substantial annual cost to users of the road.
And 3.5 billion hours annually of delay on the highways, that's five times as many as in the early 1980s. Why such a tremendous growth there? Why haven't highways kept up with demand?
Well, remember, keep one thing in mind, that there are people who avoid highways because of congestion. So even when you build an additional unit of capacity, that may very well draw people who were avoiding the roads in the first place, traveling off-peak, different modes, so on and so forth. And so when you actually build the road, it attracts more people, hence the popular slogan, if you build it, they will come.
Robert Poole.
So it's a never-ending spiral.
Up and up. We've heard about that. It leaves us wondering how private highways or higher tolls would get us out of that spiral. Robert Poole, in Texas, there's a huge experiment underway. This, what's it called, the Trans-Texas Corridor, mega highway, dwarfs the Eisenhower interstate system in its scale, as I look at it. Can you describe what's going on there for us?
Yes. Governor Rick Perry of Texas decided that at the start of his administration that for Texas to remain competitive, it really needed to do something dramatic to improve transportation, not only of people, but of goods as well. And so instead of adding lanes to existing interstates and freeways, which they are doing to some extent, and they're doing it with tolls, he also decided on this Trans-Texas Corridor idea, which was to put four or five major brand-new corridors, north-south and east-west, not part of the existing interstate corridor.
Right, brand new grid laid down.
That would not go through the existing urban areas, and that would be wide enough to have truck-only lanes, car lanes, rail lines, pipelines, communications lines, and so forth. Basically, overall multipurpose utility corridors, and as much as possible to have these things privately financed and operated.
And massive. Each corridor, 6 lanes for cars, 4 lanes for 18-wheel trucks, half a dozen rail lines, and as you say, utility zone for oil and water and even broadband
Internet.
Nobody
knows if all of that will eventually actually be done. The part that's of most interest so far is the highway, the auto and truck portions, and the demand for the other pieces certainly remains to be seen, but it's obviously breathtaking in scale. But equally breathtaking is the first corridor that they have opened up for proposals from the private sector was one called TTC 35, which parallels Interstate 35, which goes from the Mexican border to Oklahoma. It's a major truck route, a NAFTA route.
Mm-hmm.
And I-35 is increasingly very congested much of the day along its length. And so this corridor would completely supplement that, and they put it out to bid for the private sector, and the winning proposal that they submitted was from a joint venture of the major Spanish toll road company, Cintra, and Zachary Construction in Texas. $7.2 billion of private money would be invested to build and operate this corridor in exchange for the right of that consortium to collect tolls and manage the system for 50 years.
So their profit, this would be a huge private highway, their profit would come from tolls. Would it also come from development along this new private mega highway?
That remains to be determined. There's some limited provisions for that, but we're a long way from an actual signed franchise agreement to do that. It is very much what Mr. Beatty described as a return to the original 19th century concept of a long-term exclusive franchise. But at this point in time, there's a one-year agreement to between the consortium and the Texas DOT to try to better define the project and to crunch the numbers a little more, and then there will be a negotiation to see if they actually come to something that resembles the original unsolicited proposal.
And, Mr. Poole, I may be a bit dim, but help us understand further why privatizing would ease traffic congestion. If you pour $260 billion, $286 billion in public monies in there for new roads, for improved and buffed up infrastructure, why doesn't that help? What's the difference?
What's different is that, as I said a little bit earlier, much of that money gets spent on low priority, politically important but economically unimportant projects. The majority of it goes on maintaining, patching potholes and routine repaving and maintenance of the existing massive infrastructure that we already have.
So you're saying it's mainly about allocation, though, at the margin that might address. But if the public money was poured into the most congested areas of the country, would a public solution work? Would that obviate the need for a private approach?
Well, it would certainly help. But as Cliff Winston will tell you, if it would go only on traditional free highways, you'd have this problem of the demand that's scared away because of today's level of congestion coming back and potentially reclogging the new capacity as well.
And that wouldn't happen in the private path because money is sitting there. You've got to pay the toll to get on.
You have to pay the toll, and the toll would be higher at the busy times of day so that it produces a much more balanced approach of wiser management. It means you don't have to invest as much to get the same degree of congestion relief.
You don't get those casual road cloggers out there,
exactly,
Jack Beatty, those ne'er-do-wells just heading out on the highway for no reason.
You know, we have loads of highway capacity at away from rush hours. And a lot of those trips, the large majority of trips in the morning and afternoon rush hour in every metro area in the country are not commuting trips.
But what you're saying, those drivers have just made foolish decisions, and if they had to pay a few bucks more, they'd sit home or they'd drive on the back roads? What are you suggesting?
Or they drive at a different time of day. Many of those trips could be made at other times of day. Not all of them, but if 10% of those trips were shifted to another time of day, it would make an enormous difference in the congestion levels.
Clifford Woodston, what about public transportation, mass transit? Hasn't that helped? Is that a better alternative to more highways, private highways, higher tolls?
Well, the tragedy is that as roads have continued to get more congested, use of transit continues to go down. So actually, rail transit, bus transit shares are going down simply because we have changes in land use patterns. We don't have the traditional work in one concentrated residential area, live in some residential concentrated residential area mm-hmm. and go into a direct CBD. People are now all spread out. And obviously transit, it just finds it too difficult to keep up with that. Hence, it's losing share at a time when demands on the highway are getting greater. So if anything, transit has not been helping, yet at the same time, it continues to run itself big operating and capital deficits and tend to siphon off some money that goes to highways too. So they're now jointly thought of as a multimodal approach. So money going to highways, then part of that has to go to transit at the same time that their economic fortunes are spiraling down.
So buses don't do it. Trains don't do it. Ask Americans to reach for their wallets when they hit the highway. And the suggestion here is that that might do it. Let's hear from our callers. Eric is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Thanks. What do you think?
Well, I just got back from Singapore, and I saw it in action. I thought it was terrific. Downtown Singapore, they have congestion pricing. And there was no congestion because people had to pay to be driving on the road during rush hour, during congestion period. So as a consequence, you just flew, you got to where you needed to get without any trouble. So I think this is an idea that's long overdue. I'd much rather pay some kind of a toll rather than pay in terms of, $50 billion worth of lost time sitting in traffic.
Right. Let me ask you, Eric, though, is there something... Jack raised Andrew Jackson earlier, a Jacksonian view of the world. Is there something anti-democratic about this? Because if money's no problem, you can reach for your wallet, travel whenever you like. But if money's a little tight, you're the one who's going to be squeezed off that highway.
Well, I think we should do something with the money that we get from the tolls. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of things you can buy if you have money. You can buy, bigger ice cream sundaes or whatever. But we could take the money from the tolls and use it to provide, free health care for kids or just a tax rebate. So I think everybody would be better off that rather than taking it. Essentially, now what we do is we just throw it in the ocean by having everybody sit in traffic.
Right.
That doesn't help anybody.
We got it, and we hear you're different, and by your lights, better experience in Singapore. Eric, thanks for calling. Jack, there it is. Nobody wants to sit in traffic. Eric says, well, take some of that money you make on private highways on higher tolls and help people without money with it. Of course, a bunch of it's going to go to profit if it's a market-driven solution. But do you end up maybe having less traffic congestion, but dividing American drivers into first class and coach?
Yes, you do. And I think you further one of the, most lamentable social trends of our time, that is the secession of affluent Americans from the life that most Americans live. And imagine, there you are in your Chevy, gagging on the effluvia as you're waiting and
sitting
in traffic.
Oh, not that.
And suddenly on the high-speed raid, on the high-speed lane, the Mercedes cruises by at 100 miles an hour with Joe Millionaire. And there you are, just seething. It was this sort of thing that really created the Jacksonian anger. Jacksonian editor William Leggard of the New York Evening Post wrote this: "We cannot pass the bounds of the city without paying tribute to monopoly. Our bread, our meat, our vegetables, our fuel all pay tribute to monopolists. Not a road can be opened, but not a bridge built, nor a canal dug, but a charter for exclusive privileges must be granted to corporations." And that brought a tremendous political reaction after a while. And I suspect this sort of thing, this privatized roads, would have the same effect.
He was ready to burn down the toll booth. On the other hand, it's an affluent society, and there are days when almost anybody would pay to get someplace important a little quicker. Yet, Tom is calling from Watertown, New York. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
I traveled Route 407 from Hamilton, Ontario, north of Toronto, Ontario, about once every 6 or 8 weeks. I love it. I gladly pay the toll.
Well, Tom, you're breaking up on us on your private highway there, but I can see from my note here that it's a beautiful highway, but it costs you $25 a day round trip. That raises this issue of equity in a very tangible way. Clifford Winston, what about it? What about the equity issue, the access issue, the first class versus coach? Is it a fair critique of the private higher toll path?
Well, the equity is that you are paying for the service that you prefer and that indeed that you get.
If you have the money to pay for it.
If you are willing to pay for it. Remember, we're talking about people who are commuters. So most of these people, almost all of them, are going to be employed. Most of them, of course, will also want the option. Sometimes they need to get to work quickly. And in fact, if you look at the data of those people who have been paying to use the high occupancy toll lane, so this is an example of the type of thing we're talking about in California and in Texas. In fact, these are not just wealthy people that are doing this. These are people with very moderate incomes. They don't necessarily do it every day, although actually some do. But some want the option on a couple of days a week to be able to go in and pay a bit more to get better service. So as long as you're paying for the cost of the service, that certainly is equitable. But more to the point, I think it's just a very dangerous approach to public policy to view policies that are primarily concerned with efficiency as just another social policy. We already have social policy in this country in many different forms. Trying to make that social policy part of many efficiency policies is only going to actually hurt the people that it's trying to help.
So let the market
inefficient highway, building an inefficient highway where you don't price for service is not a good way to allocate resources and help poor people. I think what one needs to do is let the market work where it's going to be appropriately effective and have your social policy that is designed to redistribute money in minimum cost ways.
And you're saying that this could be with private highways, but the approach you describe as road pricing could also be implemented on public highways. That is, I guess, higher tolls for high-speed lanes.
Absolutely. Could and is. We have a policy that's doing that now. I mean, the key to privatization, let's be clear about this, is that we want privatization to accelerate the efficient use of the market in a number of dimensions. Pricing, investment, design, in ways that we can't even imagine. And we have an analog to this. It's called intercity deregulation, whereas we had the government regulating the activities of airlines, trucks, and railroads and suppressing efficient activities that we never even imagined could take place. Once we took the clamps off, so to speak, we saw a much more efficient and dynamic intercity part of the transportation system. I think all we're talking about here is trying to extend the efficiencies that we see in intercity transportation to urban transportation and infrastructure. And we see privatization as one route to do it because we would think that private entities would have the incentive and the ability to make the most efficient use of our transportation resources.
Well, Lord knows everyone would like efficiency on the highways, and nobody, regardless of their income, likes to sit in a traffic jam. But Robert Poole, isn't it in some degree social policy? Even here, Cliff Winston says, leave social policy out of it. I mean, just like public education, public roads, there is a public face.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be those dimensions to making the policy decisions. And one thing that I'd like to point out that's an obvious thing you can do if you put in pricing, whether it's on a whole freeway or on specialized lanes, to allow them to move quickly at rush hour and provide a better quality trip to drivers for a price. Those lanes, we call them managed lanes now, that are uncongested and reliable, are also a guideway for high-speed express bus service. Now, right now, a lot of transit agencies offer what they call express bus service, and most of it runs in regular freeway lanes. Some of it runs on HOV lanes, carpool lanes. But increasingly, over time, those carpool lanes, if they're successful, get congested also.
So if you're not going to tool out there in your Jaguar, tool out there in the high-speed bus, and you too can take advantage of the private.
Exactly. And without the transit agency having to invest $1 billion to build its own exclusive guideway for a rail system or for a busway, it can share the space because the pricing manages the capacity and can reserve. It can be managed to reserve 10% or 20% or whatever you want of the capacity for the high-speed bus service.
Robert Poole, Clifford Winston, Jack, we've got to take a short break here. We'll be back talking more about paying for speed on America's highways. You can join us. Is it time to bring market dynamics to the road? And coming up later in this hour, a new report finds that lobbying is the number one career for ex-congressmen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Asprug. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about paying for speed on America's highways, about the drive to fill in the transportation bill's potholes with private roads and higher tolls. You can join us. What do you think? Is it time to bring market dynamics to the problem of traffic gridlock? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined in this hour by Robert Poole at the Reason Foundation, Clifford Winston at the Brookings Institution. Jack Beatty's with us. And right now, Charles is calling from Thompson, Georgia. Hi, Charles. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, you know, I guess it's got its good points and bad points, and to me, most of them are bad points, especially with the Supreme Court ruling now that private corporations can, through eminent domain, come and take your property to build a big highway, I suppose.
Yes.
You
mm-hmm.
know, I think it's going in the wrong direction. We need to go to more mass transit. People need to plan their day better so they're not rushed, you know. It's a little bit ridiculous to me. You go through Atlanta, and they probably paved over and built everything that they can build. I heard one of the DOT people saying not long ago they had built just about all the highway they could build.
But you've got terrible gridlock in Atlanta in recent years.
You do, but so, you have really poor mass transit, you know.
So you'd rather have mass transit than pay an extra $5 or $10 to zip downtown or wherever you're headed?
Well, even if it's, you know, if it's all private, who's to say it's going to be $5 or $10? You know, like the guy said, it was $25 a day.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to pay $700 a month to go down the highway to go to work.
We hear that. And of course, the Supreme Court ruling on eminent domain seems eminently relevant here. Charles, thank you very much for your call. To speak to that, I want to turn to Michael Replogle. He joins us from Chevy Chase, Maryland. He is Transportation Director at Environmental Defense, a watchdog group on the environment. Michael Replogle, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you. I think this is a real timely topic. You know, the bottom line on this is that tolls can help us better manage traffic congestion, give people better choices, or they can be used to just make our congestion problem worse by simply going to build more lanes and more sprawl and to worsen the inequities of our society. The same's true of private investment in transportation. I think this can be a good thing to help us get better projects built faster, or it can work very much against protections for the environment and labor.
So how do you judge exactly what's going on, Mr. Replogle? You see in this huge transportation bill a provision that would allow private companies to raise up to $15 billion for highway projects with bonds that are exempt from federal income taxes. Is that a step in the right direction? Are we cracking open the future there? Is it a good future?
Well, I think we're going to have to watch the experience with this very closely, and a lot depends on how these get implemented. If they're just used as a way to do an end run around environmental protections and protections for clean air and public health and communities, then it's definitely a negative development. But if it's used to help us better manage some of the existing roads that we've got, and if we tie these new private investments to performance and insist that they improve environmental quality, that they reduce the adverse impacts of our roads on our streams, on our on the noise of the neighborhoods, and demand that these investments bring with them investments in better public transportation to operate either on these new managed lanes or parallel to these new managed lanes, it could be a good thing. It could be a way for us to build a 21st century transportation system. Mm.
Robert Poole, I wish you would speak to the environmental issue here, a plus or a minus on the privatizing front.
Well, I think it's as Michael said, it depends on what the rules of the game are going to be. And I think clearly there should be a level playing field. The private sector should comply with all the same environmental standards as if it's building a new highway or new lanes as the public sector would. But I detected perhaps in what Michael was saying that Perhaps he's suggesting that it'd be more stringent requirements for performance or mitigation or so forth. And I don't see a call for that. It seems to me that what we want to do is have a level playing field to encourage the kind of innovations that that Cliff Winston and I both think the private sector can bring to the table, but without hobbling it with more stringent restrictions than apply to the public sector.
So you say fair is fair. I was thinking less of the wetlands issue or lands that might be lost, though that is an issue, but more of overall pollution from vehicle traffic in the United States.
Well, if you actually look at the numbers on what's happening, we are our emissions from automobiles of the criteria pollutants, you know, the carbon monoxide and nitrogen oxides and so forth, are going down. Even though we're driving more vehicle miles traveled every year, the actual emission levels are decreasing over time. And with as the vehicle fleet turns over the next 20 years, and all the cars on the road are having to comply with the latest tailpipe emission standards, urban air pollution from vehicles is going to be a declining problem.
Well, there certainly is a decrease from cleaner vehicles and fuels, but we still have a long way to go to protect public health. The science is showing us in the last few years that there's serious cancer risks from the mobile source air toxics that come from cars and trucks and diesel exhaust, and it's going to take a long time to clean up those older, dirtier vehicles.
But Michael Ruplogle, if those big trucks, let's say, were being whisked along a big private highway, spending less time sitting in traffic, do you see that as diminishing air pollution from that traffic or simply inviting more 18-wheelers onto the highways and we ratchet up again?
It all depends on how we manage the system. I think there may be a place in some areas for truck toll lanes. There may be places for expanding our highway system with new private lanes, but we need to bring with that better toll management, price management of existing lanes, and not just use it to build a whole new network like they're doing in Texas. I think the Texas thing is a real scary thing where perhaps we're given too much power to private companies to come in, for example, and take people's land. David Langford's family, homesteaded their ranch in 1851, and they could lose that ranch in 90 days under the quick claim.
Yeah, I know how that goes. I had a family farm that got cut in half by an interstate, and it's no fun. I want to get another call here. Marvin is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Marvin. You're on the air. What do you think?
What I think is the privatization of the highways would make more sense. It would just be that these companies would have to maintain these roads to better specifications than what they are being maintained by the state government. They don't have the resources to keep these roads up.
And are you willing to reach for your wallet every time you go on for the pleasure of driving on those better maintained roads?
Yes, I would. It would be not a problem. It's kind of a lazy life up here in Burlington. Not really lazy, but I don't have to get places that quickly. But when I need to go to New York, if I have to, I would gladly pay the $20 to be in the high speed lane. It would be not a problem. I think a lot of people would agree with me.
Well, there's the American who's ready to go, and there are clearly some significant forces here that may put a wind at your back, Marvin, and thanks for your call. Cliff Winston, last thought to you in this hour. Is this coming? Is the sun coming up on this era of higher tolls, of more private roads? It's going to happen.
Well, the key thing are experiments, and I think the comment, maybe Michael made it, that this all depends on how this is implemented is extremely important. If we see successful experiments where we have private ownership and management of roads, it actually shows improvements in traffic flow, efficiency, so on and so forth, then that's how you get the movement going. Again, the analogy with inner city deregulation is very important. The way that was sold was experiments. In California, one saw what happened with intrastate deregulation and saw fares were lower in California within the state than they were interstate in other parts of the country. If the experiments work, then I think things will start slowly moving because there clearly is room for improvement. But if it's mismanaged, then you could have the California electricity privatization experience, such as it was.
Enron Redux.
Privatization gets a bad name. So it's extremely important to think of these as experiments, but they have to be very well managed, and there has to be some goal on performance, and focus has to be on performance.
And keep an eye on exactly how they're doing. But we can feel this big 18-wheeler nosing out on to the highway. Clifford Winston at the Brookings Institution, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Robert Poole at the Reason Foundation, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Michael Replogle at Environmental Defense, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty, there we are. You've brought the ghost of Andrew Jackson into the room. The future is being described here as very possibly more market-driven, necessarily monopoly-driven, necessarily at the little guy's expense?
Well, at least that's been the way in the past, but it may be necessarily at the expense of our posterity. I mean, look at this the way people from 100 years from now will look at it. And from everything we see, they're going to have huge problems with global warming, perhaps even irretrievable problems. And they're going to look back and they're going to say, wait a minute, weren't you thinking of us? I mean, you weren't paying the real cost of the use of gasoline. You weren't paying for your foreign policy. You weren't setting up the incentives that would leave, for example, that in France, allow a man 200 miles away to commute to Paris in an hour and 15 minutes. If you lived in L.A., you could live in Arizona and get there in that time. That's the way we need to turn.
Meanwhile, the quarter-mile-wide highways are being dug in Texas. Jack, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
In a moment, a new report finds that lobbying is the number one career for ex-congressmen. This is On Point. More than 40% of eligible members of Congress who have left office since 1998 have become lobbyists, according to a new study by the watchdog group Public Citizen, and many of them have made piles of money. More Republicans than Democrats move on to Washington's K Street lobbying gulch, but a third of departing Democrats head there too. The new study raises questions about the tight relationship between K Street and Capitol Hill. Joining me now is Brad White, Director of Investigations and Research at Public Citizen's Congress Watch Division. Brad White, thanks for being with us. What have you found here?
Tom, it's quite amazing. Your previous segment where you were talking about paying for speed, you might easily entitle this segment paying for influence.
Right.
No one is surprised that members of Congress become lobbyists. It's been written about those who cover inside the Beltway the workings of Capitol Hill have reported about this. What we wanted to do was get a definitive quantitative value on it. And quite frankly, we were surprised that since 1998, which is when the Senate Office of Public Records put online lobbyist registration statements, since 1998, of the roughly 198 members of Congress who are eligible to lobby, about 86, in fact, registered to lobby, which is 43%, as you mentioned in the lead-in.
I have to say that was a striking number, even though we knew that many congresspeople were headed off to lobbying land. That's an amazing number.
It was striking to us as well. We've been working on the database where we got this number for the better part of a year. We were surprised, and I'm a former journalist. I think it takes a lot to surprise me. Other stats, not to burden you with a lot of numbers here, but that the fact that two-thirds of Republican senators, 12 out of 18 departing senators since 98, became lobbyists, that to me is a striking number.
You remind us that people who serve in Congress have privileges that go with them after they leave Congress that turn them into kind of super lobbyists by definition. What are those?
They have access. If you're a former member of Congress, you have access to places on Capitol Hill that the public does not, that other lobbyists who were not members of Congress do not. You have access to members-only gymnasiums, to certain dining rooms, to certain anterooms off the House floor. You can go places and do things. In other words, in this town, to a very large extent, your value is measured by your face time. And as a lobbyist, that's amplified exponentially. So a lobbyist's true value is his face time with a member. If you are a former member and you can corner a current member, one of your old cronies.
Right. In the gym, at the dining hall, in the ante room, that's incredible.
Exactly. And you can slip him saying, hey, I'm not trying to high pressure you, but give this to the appropriate staffer who works public transportation, for example. Check it out. We think it has some value.
Brad, what
right
are you
there?
That's tremendous access, and we can see that. You're a lobbyist now, not a congressperson, but you're inside the Capitol Hill Castle. You're right next to them on the exercycle or having lunch. What are the measures that you're proposing here to dampen this trend toward ex-congressmen and women turning right around and becoming lobbyists?
Basically, what we're suggesting, Tom, is, particularly when we saw the numbers that were involved here, there is what's called a cooling off period. In other words, if you're a member of Congress and you want to register to become a lobbyist, you can't do that immediately. You have to wait a year, mm-hmm. what's called the cooling off period, before you can register to become a lobbyist. We want that extended to at least 2 years, which is the length of a congressional session. Most people think a session of Congress is 1 year. In point of fact, it's 2 years.
What about access to those gyms and restaurants and ante rooms?
Our feeling is that if you're a former member and you register to become a lobbyist, all that's gone. You give that up.
And what about how people negotiate their contracts, their future employment as lobbyists? People who are chairman of very influential committees apparently negotiating these deals before they ever leave Congress.
That's just absolutely egregious. I mean, you're a federal lawmaker. You're there because the people in your district sent you to Congress to represent them. And you're on Capitol Hill, involved in oversight hearings, involved in legislation, and you're negotiating a job with somebody who very likely the reason they want you is because they have business pending before the committee you're a member of. That's incredibly egregious. And so what we're proposing is that if you're going to negotiate a job, it should all be open. You should be required to put everything on the table so that if there is any undue influence, mm-hmm. if there is any contradiction of ethics, it's out there for everyone to see.
Well, with nearly half of ex-Congress people headed off to lobbying, we can see some headwind on those suggestions. Brad, but we're glad you ran the numbers and glad you've raised them for us. Thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, thank you.
Brad White, Director of Investigations and Research at the watchdog group Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. He spoke with me from Bethesda, Maryland. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Lieber, Matt Odette, and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.